To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Let's talk about copyright and stuff another time, because plagiarism is fascinating to me because the courts get it wrong all the time.
You heard it here first.
Yes, right.
Plagiarism is fascinating.
And so that's right. Yeah, students, you want to fascinate me? Plagiarize in your papers.
Try to catch us.
That's right. So hi, I'm Mark. Go.
You go.
Hi, I'm Mark.
And I'm Nicole, and this is Nevermind the Music. What are we talking about today, Mark?
I want to talk about Weezer. Finally, it feels like Weezer is a band we would have talked about really early in this podcast.
Yeah, but I think both of us are. I'm a Weezer fan, and it's really on brand for me to like Weezer, and you as well. Do you know they're touring and they're doing the whole Blue album on tour?
I know. I am actually planning on it. I haven't seen Weezer since probably 2000. I want to talk about that, actually. Let's talk about Weezer, our Weezer levels of Weezer fandom. But first, folks, we are talking about Undone, the Sweater song from 1994. If you want to destroy my sweater, hold this thread as I walk with it. Okay, so we both like Weezer. We're both Weezer fans.
Yes.
I feel like nobody is surprised by that. Being our generation and our level of nerdiness, or at least mine. And that's how they were kind of felt to me at first, like the cool nerds.
Sure, right. Definitely, so, like a coolish nerd.
So when were you, what's the height of your Weezer fandom? What's your deal?
I'd say I'm like a 1 to 10. I'm probably like a 6, but I want to be a 10. Like, I want to be someone that really likes, like, knows everything about Weezer because I respect them a lot. But I just don't really like...
Like, when were you listening to Weezer?
I think like the Blue album was the one that like really kind of got me.
I think you and a lot of other people,
right? So I feel very basic in my Weezer like fandom, but I just like them a lot. I think their lyrics are great. Their sound is great. It is like they're iconically Weezer. Like no one else really sounds like them.
I agree. Blue album era, right? Mm-hmm. But for me, I think I discovered them a little late. It was more like high school for me, which because I was a little younger when this album came out. But by the time I was in high school, I was certainly a fan of this. And Pinkerton had already come
out. Yes. So when Pinkerton came out, that's like when I started like noticing Weezer. And then I went back and listened to the Blue album.
Okay. It's possible that's kind of the timeline for me too.
Because in middle school, I wasn't like into music.
I want to ask you about Pinkerton too, but this song was a big hit, their first single.
Mm-hmm.
It was their, and maybe we're jumping too far forward, but this song hit number 57 on the Billboard Hot 100. It was much higher on the rock charts, but...
Oh, I was like, that seems low.
It seems low, but Buddy Holly and Say It Ain't So...
Oh, yeah.
...didn't even chart.
What?
So this song, like... Okay, by the way, Say It Ain't So, I would say... I mean, I'm fine with Undone, but Say It Ain't So was the song that, when I heard it, I was like, oh my God, this band is amazing.
Yeah. But it's such a good song.
Definitely. But am I crazy? Didn't it feel like Buddy Holly, especially with the Buddy Holly video and this song, were like way bigger than Undone. Not true at all.
That doesn't even make sense to me. I think that this is like a glitch in the simulation.
Is this like the Berenstain Bears versus Berenstain Bears thing?
Maybe, because Buddy Holly was a popular song, like with the video, and it was like a Happy Days video, and it was like the whole thing.
Wait, have we just discovered a new Mandela effect?
Was Weezer popular?
No. It's not. I mean, we haven't talked about the Mandela
effect,
right? But I mentioned the Berenstain Bears. That's one. Like, people my generation grew up reading those books, and we each, all of us remember a different spelling of it.
Yeah.
People remember Nelson Mandela dying in prison when he very much did not die in prison.
Is that why it's called the Mandela effect?
Mandela. What was I saying?
I always thought it was the Mandela effect.
Mandela. It's Nelson Mandela.
Because of Nelson Mandela.
People thought the politician / political activist from South Africa had died in prison, when in reality he did not. He became the president
of the
post-apartheid South African state for a while. And it's this idea that really what it is, it's about weird collective mismatched memory.
Yeah.
But the theory, you can explain this better than me, but the theory is like, is the Mandela effect a proof of the existence of split timelines?
Well,
parallel universes.
I'm a nerd for string theory, and I think that parallel universes for sure do exist. And I love the idea that one small change can ripple you down like this whole, it can open up this whole other timeline. And
right. You are a Zelda fan. We've talked about that, right?
I'm very into it. I don't think we've talked about it on the podcast.
Oh, we haven't talked about it.
But don't get me started.
Apparently, I've just outed. Big surprise. We like Zelda. Zelda very famously has a game, 1990-something's Ocarina of Time.
Yeah.
That because there's time travel, it creates multiple trees of plot. And so a given Zelda game, like one that comes out in 2020 or whatever, versus 2015, one of them may exist in a different timeline than the others, etc. And it's confusing and it doesn't matter because it's just a game.
It does matter.
But it matters.
It matters.
But how we stumbled upon, also... didn't expect to be talking about this.
I love it.
Have we stumbled upon something like the Mandela effect? Because in this case, provably so, Undone - the sweater song, not parentheses, - was a bigger hit than these songs. But have you seen the music video to this song?
The sweater song?
Yeah.
If I saw it, I would probably remember it, but I can't remember it offhand.
It's them playing the song and some kooky things happen and there's a blue background, so it feels very Weezer.
Sure.
But I literally had never seen that video until I was prepping this episode, yeah. AKA 2 days ago. And this video, by all accounts, was a huge hit on MTV. Whereas I feel like I saw the Buddy Holly video all the time. I saw Say You Dance So quite a bit. Now, granted, we already said I kind of missed the first run of this band. Like it was more like when I was in high school, when I was seeing all that stuff.
Sure.
But I was still a fan of music in middle school. So like, this is wild to me. And also, why this song? This is a weird, Weezer's weird. I get it. It's goofy. I wonder why this song was their first single.
Because it's not like a single. Like Buddy Holly is a single.
In the sense of like
it appeals to like, yeah, like a pop audience. And then you think of adding in the video, and that had a lot of pop references and was really like accessible to a broad audience. Like this song is weird to be first out of the gate for a band.
Yeah. You mentioned like the sort of singleness of Buddy Holly. My parents, I think my mom, I don't remember, but I think it was my mom, literally thought that it was a cover. This sounds like a song from the 50s or the 60s or whatever. And
yeah.
I'm like, no, that's a new song. That's Weezer. Like, and it had that sound. It has that you've heard this your whole life kind of sound that makes it a great single. And I could have sworn that this song was a minor one. Like Undone, is that better? I can remember kids singing it in like middle school classes and me being like, oh, is that a real song? There's no way that's a real song. And no, it was their biggest hit all the way until
Island in the Sun, probably
way past that.
What?
All the way until Beverly Hills,
which
is
gosh.
In like, what is that? 2003 or something like that.
That's not my favorite one.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Let's circle around Weezer fandom for a bit.
Sure.
So I certainly super into Blue Album.
Mm-hmm.
Pinkerton is the album that the music nerd friends of mine were like, oh, you like the Blue Album? Well, Pinkerton is just so much smarter, so much.
Sure.
And I'm trying to think of what another example of that was, but
it's like Taylor. I'm going to talk about Taylor Swift. It's like when you say like, oh, 1989 is my favorite album. It's like, oh, you need to listen to Folklore.
You need to listen to Folklore. Don't you like reverbed out piano? You got to listen to Folklore.
Folklore
yeah.
is like a masterclass, but we don't have to.
Folklore versus Evermore. You're a folklorist.
I like Folklore better. Yeah.
Folklore is pretty. Also just it's the first one of those I heard, and so it felt so like surprising.
Folklore for me is the first Taylor Swift album that didn't feel poppy to me. I was always kind of put off for her being too poppy, like it's just not my style of music. So when I heard Folklore and then later like learned about her writing process for it, I realized she's actually a songwriter. Like that's what she is. And that kind of reframed Taylor Swift for me. But so when people say like, oh, Red's my favorite album, or like Taylor Swift debuts my favorite album, it's like, all right, like, why don't you listen to Folklore?
Yeah, I'm totally a music snob. I think I like 1989 more.
It's a great album.
So anyways, like, the crazy thing, music nerd I am, of course, years later becoming ever more so, I have revisited Pinkerton so many times going, this is the time I'm going to hear Pinkerton and I'm going to realize that it's the best thing ever.
Has it ever happened?
It has never happened.
Yeah, I don't think
and
it is.
I like some of the songs on Pinkerton.
What's like the top single? Like, if you know one song on Pinkerton, what's it going to be?
El Scorcho.
Okay.
Which is weird, but like, it has like, The Good Life is an excellent song. It has some really like weird, you know, Tired of Sex is just like a weird opener, but like, it has some really great stuff. It's just a weird listen now. Folks, write in. Tell me why I'm wrong. I actually want to know why I'm wrong, because I still think Blue is better. We're going too long about this. So I like Blue so much.
It's such a great, it's a perfect album.
When I was like, it's formation foundational to certain aspects of me, not just as a songwriter, but me as a performer, to the point that later in high school, my Rage Against the Machine tribute band.
Oh my gosh.
That happened to serve just to serve the purpose of a talent show, basically. And we played the last day of high school. We transitioned into a Weezer.
Oh my gosh.
Blue album cover band. And so, but the reason I say it's important.
Let's pause.
Okay.
Just a what? Weezer Blue album cover band. All you played was the Blue album.
Well, we only played for that summer before everybody left for college.
Oh, that's all you could get.
And that's the songs everybody liked, even though we had some of those music nerds that were like, would have advocated for a Pinkerton cover album. But
all right.
But like, it was foundational. Like, there's something about the vocal, the backing. I wasn't the lead vocalist of that. We had a woman, well, a teenage girl lead vocalist.
She was probably a woman by then.
Well, let's see. I'd have to check her birthday,
we can ask her. Right in.
Shout out to Maureen.
Maureen.
Hey, Maureen. So I was like the high backup vocalist, and it was the first time in my life I'd ever used falsetto. Oh. You know the term falsetto?
Yes.
Yeah. So think the high sort of boy voice that a man, or in that case, a teenage boy can use. Mm. I was super inspired by Matt Sharp. You know Matt Sharp by name?
Yeah, it's like Matt Sharp and the...
Well...
Some, right? Isn't he in a band that's like Matt Sharp
He and might the... now. He was solo for a while. So he split off and made... He was the bassist, the original bassist of Weezer for their first two albums. And he split off into a band called The Rentals.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember them?
No.
They have the song Friends of P from 1995.
What is P a reference to?
I have no idea.
It's not a great song.
It fits that nerd rock kind of vibe.
It sounds like a Weezer cover band.
It sounds kind of like similar to that. Yeah. So and the other vocalists in the band like would guest on Weezer songs and stuff like that.
Well, that's cool.
The women,
so they
vocalists,
had like a good relationship.
They were cool. But he was the bassist, and what his deal was he would sing high falsetto, really goofy sounding harmonies. In this moment here.
Yeah.
It's so goofy.
It's the best part of the song, I think.
It's kind of the best part of the song. And here I am in my high school.
You're like, I can do it.
June,
put me in.
Trying it.
How do you even have that?
How do I have that?
Was it like recorded on a cassette tape?
Our bassist, I think Ted, recorded it on some like, he might have even had like a, remember those mini disc players or whatever? He had something like that.
Sure.
This is late 90s or maybe 2000 or whatever. We rehearsed and he just it's wild. Like, I have a few recordings and we sound like you would expect us to sound.
I mean, it's dragging a little bit, but you guys have it.
We have it. And that's me, my first ever falsetto experience on the high notes.
Well,
but anyways, the weird thing about Weezer is this is, you said what, you're a 6 out of 10, but you wish you were a 10.
Yeah. Like, I want to be someone that's like, knows a lot about Weezer.
What do you think of new Weezer? By new, I mean anything after like 2000.
Right?
Like 10 really albums, like, or whatever.
I mean, I referenced Island in the Sun. I really think that that's a great song.
From the Green Album,
from
the third
green
record.
Album,
yeah.
The like, Lime Green Album.
Yeah, called Weezer, of
yes,
course.
Smart. And that's all I got.
I think this is about the like least original thing anybody, like a musician or whatever, can say. But I can't keep up with Weezer. Like, I'm similar. Now, yeah. The reason I fell off, like, I wasn't not a Weezer fan with Pinkerton. I just couldn't see the genius that other people saw. I was really, but like, I liked some of the songs. I liked the vibe. I was not into the Green Album. I like the song Island in the Sun. I think it's great. The production style of that album, it's so cheesy.
Yeah, that's why I like it.
You like, I think there's some cool stuff on it. Like Hashpipe does not fit that. It's not cheesy. It's
like a
really
satire of Weezer. Like they're in on the joke.
Sort of. It felt like I couldn't tell if they were just trying to recreate Blue Album and failing, or if they were making fun of themselves.
I think they were making fun of themselves.
You think? Because they just stayed that way.
Do they still have new albums? Like when was their last newest album?
Like recent. Like last couple years.
What?
So do you know about the colors too? They have a blue album, a green album, a red album, a white album, a teal album, and a black album.
Oh.
But you don't remember the teal album. The teal album came out was when they had the Toto cover, the Africa cover that got totally blew up. And it's an all cover album. They still totally do music. And this is not, I'm not saying Weezer sucks. I'm not saying, I'm just saying I've tried even recently. I made a playlist of all their, like, not just singles, but like I looked up what are the people's favorite songs. Cause I'm not going to listen to every album until they sell me. Like I need to be sold, because starting in the 2000s, I started just not liking their music. Although there's that one song, Perfect Situation, from their album Make Believe 2005. I did like that when it came out. Singing, oh, 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 singing. Really great lyrics in the chorus, right?
Sure.
But
they all sound the same. Like, it sounds like every other Weezer song.
And when Beverly Hills blew up so big, that's probably their biggest overall hit ever. It's sort of like, now you have to prove to me that I want to listen to Weezer. So I got like a playlist together of like singles and their notable songs. And some of it I liked, but I struggled to, like, you know, that kind of thing where like an artist you kind of discounted and then you realize, oh my God, they have so many hits, so many good songs I forgot about.
Yeah.
I'm kind of like, oh my God, they're sort of just whatever. And that bums me out a lot. And I feel so unoriginal saying that.
Is that like a common Weezer critique?
I feel like it's common to say, well, I like their, it's like if you talk to someone our age about The Simpsons, they're like, well, the 90s Simpsons amazing. It's not good now, right? Even though it's been 25 years of it. I haven't.
More than 25, but
no,
it's
no,
been like,
since, yes, since the
90s. Since the 90s. That
I haven't,
can't be right,
watched much of that. So it's hard to have a vote there. But like, I feel very like old man yelling at cloud or whatever,
sure,
to say, to say Weezer was good back when they were 23 years
right,
old or whatever they were. Hi, everybody. Mark here. During the editing process later on, I realize now I said like so many times while recording that passage. I don't know. I guess I'm not at my A game in terms of code switching when we recorded this episode. In any case, we're going to have to try to move on. You're just going to have to live with it. You can bill me if you want. Sue me. I don't know. I'm going to have to live with myself. You're going to have to live with it too. Let's get back on track.
Okay.
So we are here to talk about Undone, hyphen the sweater song. Not to get too off track again, but do you like a good parentheses, or do you like that they used a hyphen instead?
I don't have an opinion.
All right. That's highly appropriate.
Yeah.
To not have an opinion.
I just don't have an opinion about that. I've
tend
never
to not
of
do
it.
Parentheses either, but I also have, I am also a no hit wonder. So here we are.
If you want to destroy my sweater, hold this dread.
Interestingly enough, that section of the song does not have really any of the elements that I really want to talk about.
Okay.
Except for one aspect of the chord progression. The seed of what I want to talk about is in the intro to this song. And basically, there's a note or maybe a pair of notes or a kind of dissonance between the notes, which means a clashing between the notes. That is what I want to talk about. Here's the beginning of the tune. Any notes on it?
No, I like it.
It's cool, right?
Yeah, I like it.
It's a simple, relatively clean electric guitar riff that mostly doesn't change, except the bass note changes both on the bass guitar and on the electric guitar.
It's very monotone in a way that's reflective of what this song is about.
Interesting.
That's how it settles you into like what the song is about.
Let's get there.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Before we get into that, though, there's like a lot of juice behind this song in terms of influences from previous songs, but also just previous styles of music that I think is worth pointing out, even though it's not really the main thrust of what I want to talk about. Always a sidetrack. So this won't be a real sidetrack, though. So the chord progression, and I mentioned the hook doesn't have a lot that I'm planning on talking about in this episode, but it does have the same chords as that opening. And it's a classic rock and roll progression. Listen, I'll play it in the hook, but it's the same in the verse in the intro. If you want to destroy my sweater. And then in the intro. Does that sound familiar at all?
Yeah, they sound the same.
Does it sound like any songs you've heard before?
It sounds like a lot of songs I've heard before, but I can't pinpoint what they are.
Right. So this progression goes the one, which is the main. This song's in the key of G flat or F sharp.
F sharp.
Yeah, that's right. You got me to it. Yeah. No, so interestingly enough, you play the song in G play it like Weezer, but you tune your guitar down one.
They do
one
that a
half
lot.
Step. They do that for the entirety of the album, actually. So it's pretty common in 90s like hard rock is to give your guitar some of those extra low beefy notes. Usually use thicker strings also. So it's played in G, but sounds in G flat or F sharp. And it goes 1-4-5-4.
Okay.
And so we have this sort of loop of these chords. And this progression is super common, though admittedly not as common lately. It's more like kind of classic rock and roll, old 50s, 60s songs that you'll hear it. This is where it was, I would say, most popularized.
Very familiar with Louie Louie.
Yeah, so Louie Louie, that's the 1956 original by Richard Berry.
Marching Band classic.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good, that sounds... But so you're playing the tune on flute?
A piccolo, actually, in the marching
piccolo.
Band.
You were the piccolo. So you were playing who knows what? Melody? You were playing the bass line? Wow. Yeah. See, that's the chord progression. 1-4-5-4. Of course, the Kingsman version, maybe a bigger single.
Oh, sure.
Louie Louie. That's the more rock and roll. Yes. This is sort of the R&B version, the original. And even this song, though, is based on an earlier song. Cuban band leader René Touzet's 1956, though just before, El Loco Cha-Cha-Cha.
Wow. How'd they get away with that? That was before litigation and music.
It was not before litigation and music, but I should say, this is probably got to have to be a sidetrack for another time because I would want to prepare some examples.
Yes.
But I have a lot of thoughts. Copyright law does not include chord progressions.
Yes.
Copyright includes lyrics and melody. So that is not a melody. That is, could say it's a riff, but it's a chord progression and chord progressions cannot be copyrighted. Now,
that's stupid.
There are...
I challenge that.
I would say as a songwriter that that's not stupid there's only so many chord progressions that are work. Do we want Richard Berry to have a songwriting credit on Undone, the Sweater Song by Weezer?
I kind of do.
You kind of do. Because he's a black R&B artist from the 50s that's kind of forgotten. Yes,
and his
in that regard.
Could probably benefit
that's right.
from that.
But do we want the first, like, put it this way. A lot of jazz and pop songs go 2-5-1. That's their chord progression. And they're basically 2-5-1 forever. The Copyright Act was passed in 1923. People had been doing 2-5-1 since the beginning of jazz and since classical music. Do we want the first song published after the passing of the Copyright Act to then be able to claim copyright on that idea that had existed for 600 years, but because they were the first after the law was passed, now anybody doing 2-5-1 for the next 100 years owes that. Melodies are like this too, rhythms are like this too, but chord progressions are like the building, like we talked about the backbeat in an episode that maybe is airing before this. The backbeat is that beat that's core to like rock music. Do we want whoever was the first probably jazz or R&B artist in the 30s to get copyright money for every single song ever? I don't know. It's just sort of a foundational layer.
Sure.
The person who invented the major scale back in, you know, 600 AD should get, or 600 BC probably should get copyright, right? It's a foundational element.
Well, I think just to keep us on track, I'm just going to agree with
talk
you.
Talk about it later.
And we'll talk about it later.
So and I'm also like, I'll just say this, like, I don't feel 100% that in no cases should it be copyrightable, but chord progressions, just as it is, it's sketchy. It's problematic if we say...
So where does it end?
Where does it end? Because none of them are original. None of them.
Yeah, right? That's fair.
Let's talk about copyright and stuff another time, because plagiarism is fascinating to me because the courts get it wrong all the time.
You heard it here first.
Yes, right.
Plagiarism is fascinating.
And so that's right. Yes, students, you want to fascinate me, plagiarize in your papers.
Try to so, catch
that's
us.
Right. So in any case, whether it's legally copied or not, it's obviously the same.
Great.
But this progression kind of has fallen out of fashion in the last like 30, 40 years.
But the Sweater Song was inspired by Louie right. and all these other kind of precursors.
It feels that way because this progression was not all over the place in the 90s, really.
Sure.
I wouldn't have thought. So
and that's why the song stood out, probably.
It might have helped in the same way that Buddy Holly had this kind of ooey-oo that felt kind of 50s also, right? They were going for this weird blend of hard rock and retro, like old school rock and roll, etc. Okay, so that's not even really what I wanted to talk about. What this conversation centers around is this. That first chord, which is, if we want to get accurate, an F sharp 6 add sharp 9.
Okay, cool. I'm in.
Four notes, right? It's got a root. It's got a note, a sixth above it. And then it's got a third, which is a note, three notes above the root. And then it's got this note that is a sharp 2, a sharp 9. Ugh, whatever. You don't need to know. It's a sharp 9th, which is a clashing note. Basically, what we get is those two higher notes are a half step crunch away from each other. Listen. You hear how those notes are super close?
Yeah.
And they buzz.
Yeah, there's a dissonant buzz to it that I love.
Dissonant buzz. And it's great. So it has both the major third, the regular sort of da, and the minor one right below it. Or in this case, we call the minor one a sharp 9 for reasons nobody cares about. It's kind of yuck, but it also sounds good. What if we got rid of the clashing notes and we just played it with just the lower of the two? So that what I did there was a play the chord as it is and then resolved it with one note difference to just be a minor triad.
Oh.
And now we could do the same, except get rid of the lower one and only play the high one. This is the major version.
That sounds so different. I like the minor one a lot better.
It's a beautiful chord.
Yeah.
But then this is what happens when we get them both at the same time. And let me just play just the two higher notes.
Ugh. It sounds like a mistake.
That's what that sounds like when you play them alone, but together, we get this really compelling, but technically really crunchy note, because we have an F sharp chord with both an A sharp and the A natural, or G double sharp. Sharp nine, it would have to be a G double sharp, but you could think of it as an A. Well, or if it's a G flat chord, it would be a
F sharp,
B flat, and a B double flat.
Wow, I am on the edge of my seat over here.
Or an A natural, yeah. So, okay, that's right. So
that's right.
The reason I talked about Louie Louie and I talked about the chord progression being retro is this clash also has a really long history in pop music, especially styles related to rock music and sort of American
these specific
pop.
Notes, chords,
not,
or just the dissonant?
The dissonance of this type on a major chord. So like, I'm not going to say necessarily A and A sharp, but it could be A and A sharp. It could be B and C. It could be F and F sharp. Anytime you have two notes next to each other played on top of a chord like this, a major three and a minor three at the same time, it is actually following in this rich tradition. But I don't even know. The funny thing is, I don't even know that Weezer is thinking of it. They're thinking of it like being baked into rock and roll. What they were thinking of, I think Rivers later admitted it, realizing after the fact, this is what he was trying to write, like a pop rock version of this.
Yep. So super good. It's Metallica.
Yeah.
Is it Orion?
That's no. Welcome Home Sanitarium.
Welcome Home Sanitarium.
From Master of Puppets 1986. Rivers started out in a metal band. So this song is not metal, but there's influence there.
Yeah.
Now that has that same sound. It does not have the same note. It does not have this major three, minor three. This has a two and a minor three together. So it's technically a different harmonic world. But what Rivers is doing when he writes this song is he takes the sound of the Metallica tune and puts it with this, what I'm going to call a blue note.
Mm-hmm.
So having the two versions of the three at the same time, and which gives us this.
And it's the Blue Album.
That's actually fascinating. I literally never thought of that, even though I prepped a whole episode about how this is about blue notes. That is hilarious.
It's the Blue Album. Maybe that's why they did it.
Maybe. I actually don't know where the
Is there also a teal note and a white note?
No.
And do they track to the other albums?
There's not, well, there's white keys and black keys.
Yeah, well, okay.
And they have black.
We're stretching.
But see, their album is just called Weezer.
Sure.
We all started calling it the Blue Album.
Because it was blue.
Because it was blue. Because of, you know.
Or maybe subconsciously we knew about blue notes and like that we made that connection.
Because remember, the blue note
comes
from this clash here.
Yeah.
Right.
Sorry, I got really excited about that and cut you off.
Thank you for catching that.
Synchronicity, man.
This has a different dissonance to the Metallica song that comes from this idea of a blue note. So let me kind of explain where I'm coming from with this. This is I Believe I'll Dust My Broom by the Delta Bluesman, Robert Johnson. So this recording is made in 1936, but the idea of a blue note and the idea of this kind of Delta blues, like think the Mississippi River Delta, Southern United States, goes back way before anybody was recording this. Probably late 1800s, early 20th century. So take a listen. What the blue note is him being a little flat on purpose.
Okay.
To be just crunchy.
I'm going to get up in the morning. I believe I'll dust my broom. I'm going to get up in the morning. I believe I'll dust my broom.
I love that.
It's awesome. Super influential. Robert Johnson in particular, very influential on the early rock and roll guys like Keith Richards and...
Yeah. That was a man singing?
Yeah. Robert Johnson.
Robert Johnson.
Sold his soul to the devil? You don't know?
Sounds like a girl.
Does he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe he's a they, them.
I don't know. I think he sounds like a blues man to me. But
that's fair.
He's got a high singing voice. That's
well,
sure.
That's it.
When he goes, I'm going to get up in the morning, get up in the... He's not quite on the major third and not quite on the minor third. He's kind of halfway in between, but he's playing a major chord. So he should be, I'm gonna get up in the morning, but he's gonna get up in the morning. He's not quite all the way low. We call that a blue note. It's emotional.
Sure.
It's associated with the blues, of course, right?
Right.
And this becomes a big thing. And not only the blues, but jazz takes it. And eventually it gets to R&B, which then gets to rock. So this is Meade Lux Lewis with Honky Tonk Train Blues. This is 1927. So actually recorded before the Robert Johnson tune. This is an example of what we call boogie woogie, which is sort of like a fast blues based R&B. Okay. So the deal with this is on the piano. You can't bend the piano.
Mm.
You can't go get up in the... So how do you get... And maybe this will tell you where I'm going with this. How do you get the piano to sound like a blue note? You play both of the notes at the same time.
Sure.
If you need a note between an A and an A sharp, you can't go halfway between like Robert Johnson. You just bang them both at the same time. So when you hear this super clash happening, this accented dissonance, that's what's happening. Those are blue notes.
And it has the same effect that we see in the Weezer song and the Metallica song and all these other songs that you're playing. It has that same effect, but just achieved in a different way.
Right. I mean, right. I would say you say in a different way, but I think this, the blues piano solution to the how to do a blue note is then used by Weezer, because how do you get that emotional effect? You play two notes at the same time.
Right, right.
You can bend a guitar note, but that's not what this kind of, it's not a guitar solo. It's a guitar progression more than anything. It's a riff. And so they just get, they're just playing them clashing at the same time. And this major and minor third happening at the same time, or music nerds, major third and sharp nine happening at the same time, becomes a tradition in rock and roll. Here is the Hendrix chord, as people call it.
After Jimi Hendrix.
James Hendrix. Yeah.
After Hendrix.
This is the Jimi Hendrix experience playing Purple Haze from 1967. And you're going to hear what's called the Hendrix chord, which is a dominant sharp nine chord. This becomes his signature sound in a lot of ways. Listen to the guitar here. We have a major and a minor third at the same time. Same era, Taxman by the Beatles, 1966. Listen to the loud bom, bom. That is the same chord, a dominant sharp nine. Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man.
If you had to pick between the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix, who would you pick?
To survive into adulthood? What do you mean? Who do I like more?
Yeah.
I'm a songwriter. I'm a composer. I go with the Beatles.
Yeah.
I love Jimi Hendrix experience.
I'm envious
of how he's able to sing while he plays the guitar like that. But come on, it's the Beatles.
It's the Beatles, yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, just those two little clips, I was like, wow, Jimi Hendrix is so good.
But so is George Harrison with Taxman.
Yeah, for sure.
So
redacted.
But totally different kinds of good in a lot
of
ways, right?
It just hit me that they are, when you said the same era, and I don't equate them. Like, I forget that they came, it was the same time.
Yeah, it's a different crowd, continent also. The Hendrix chord and the one in Taxman is a dominant sharp 13, which is slightly different from what Rivers is using here. He has a sixth instead of a seventh. Fine, who cares? It's the same basic effect. What is clear to me is that even though maybe Rivers Cuomo is thinking about the Metallica song in his ear when he's writing this, the idea of the Louie Louie chord progression and this sharp nine thing, major minor third mixed, is just baked into the DNA. And whether he means to or not, he can't help but hear it when he's creating the song, I think. And the point of the episode, which we're finally getting to, is that this clash here, the blue note, is going to basically infect, in a good way, the rest of the song. And we're going to get little snippets of this as a concept throughout the rest of the song.
Yeah.
Let's actually move forward. So, although that was a nice little side quest there, this is the verse. Tell me, do you notice the meow now?
It's like a combination of the bass line and the vocals together, like making...
Bass line's just playing along with the guitar. Bum, bum.
That's crazy, because you hear it.
The vocal is singing.
Yeah.
Nah, nah.
Well, there you go.
Nah, nah. The vocal is just doing that clash over and over again with one singer as a melody.
Really interesting. Nah, nah.
So the A sharp. Mm-hmm. And then he's milking that guitar riff over and over again. So nothing simple. He's basically just singing the guitar part with the same rhythm and everything. So, okay, fine. We're not hearing a guitar playing it, but he's singing it. Nothing too fancy there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to the chorus where it's not really there, which is really interesting. Not there yet. But then we get to the guitar solo, which is after the second chorus, and we go to a new key. I've come undone. So it's the 1-4-5-4 Louie Louie progression, but in a new key. Guess which key?
G sharp, A flat.
We're in F sharp.
F sharp.
Our two clashy notes. The clashy note is the A natural instead of the A sharp. We have the A natural. That's the clashy note that he's added.
Okay.
What key are we in now?
A natural.
A natural, yeah.
What?
So they go to a new key. What key? Of all the keys to go to, they go to the key of the blue note. The guitar solo is just Louie Louie. Like meaning Louie Louie progression in the key of the blue note. They've gone to the blue key, which is in this case, the A major key. So this can't be totally a coincidence. I don't think like he's thinking about this meow kind of note as being important. And I think this is a really cool moment. And this, I want to hear what your thoughts are, but I also want to like give you a couple examples of this exact kind of thing happening where a weird note comes in and then they turn that note into a chord or a key change.
Yeah, I want the examples. I want
always got to have example. Although I've already played a fair amount. We lot of mix, lot of things in the mix here. Do you remember Garbage?
Oh yeah.
So they have a song Super Vixen.
She was so cute. What was her name? People like
Shirley
loved
Manson.
Her. Shirley Manson.
Yeah.
They're her.
Great. So like those of you that don't know, like alternative rock, industrial rock, kind of electronic influenced. Super Vixen from their first album, 1996, has this awesome blue note, a flat three in the guitar. And then at the end of the section, we go to that key. We go to the key of that blue note. Take a listen.
Wild, it like changes everything.
Changes so abruptly.
Yeah.
That note on that guitar part is so cool. And then they go to that key.
And it's just so clean.
Nowhere.
And her voice, her tone, or tannet. What is it?
Ooh, timbre.
Timbre, I'm learning.
Timbre.
Her timbre is so like pure and clean, which is not characteristic of that style of music. Like, so I think the female vocal in that band is really helpful for like a nice timbre.
Mm.
So there you go.
Good.
Yes,
also, that song, really awesome, notable use of actual pure silence. Not nobody's playing, but not only is nobody playing, but they cut the mics. Listen.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
It's cool.
It's not just pause. It's pause and mute all the tracks.
But imagine like live, they must really just be tight enough to pause.
The drummer would do what they call choke the cymbals.
Yeah.
But you could never get it to sound
like that.
And
not that
that's
vacant,
okay.
But.
So one more example. Do you remember Jet? Probably
I guess,
not.
Which, yeah, I don't. Two T's.
No, Jet with one T.
Oh, then no.
Jet, they had a song, Are You Gonna Be My Girl from 2003.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
This song, it goes in the different direction. There is a weird flat third. That's the blue note, right?
Mm-hmm.
A weird flat third chord in the progression on the hook. And then he sings the high scream blue note. So he gives us the chord first, which isn't that weird in a kind of blues rock context, but then he sings the blue note. It's the second chord when he says, "You home with me," that's our flat third blue note chord before he screams the blue note on the "another man." You'll hear it. Well, I could say- I don't know, maybe that's nothing, but it's kind of cool that they're kind of talking to each other.
Yeah.
The melody and the chord progression by using this, in both of these songs' cases, a blue note, something that's out of the key, but has this 100-year history in these kinds of styles of popular music. What
sure.
is this making you think of?
Well, I mean, it has, what I'm thinking about in terms of this song doesn't really have a lot to do with what you're talking about, but I still think it's valid to bring up. And that when I hear this song, I read it as being about depression. And depression is something that we haven't talked too much about on this podcast, but it's really prevalent in our society.
Sorry, can you back up your assertion that this song is about depression? Like, what makes you, like, I've read that, but this is a song that I went probably 20-something years of my life having no idea what it possibly could be about.
I really feel like it's about depression by like how the music is laid out, that there is this like dissonant and monotone repeated motif that underlies everything in the song. Even when the lyrics are changing and the mood of the song is generally changing, there's this still like this thread under everything that is very flat. And not musically flat, but has a flatter affect.
The blue note's flat.
The blue note's flat, and it has a flatter affect. Do you know what the term affect means in terms of psychology?
I think of affect like when if I'm creating a musical affect, it would be the emotional contour of that moment.
Yeah, okay. Like that's kind of similar.
What does that mean in psychology?
We use it a lot as along with the term mood, like mood and affect.
Yep.
So the way that I conceptualize this term in psychology, it really just means like how you present to another person. Like you could be in a good mood, but have a flat affect or a low affect. So if you think of, it was taught to me like thinking about climate and temperature, right? That like your climate is your affect and your mood is your temperature. So in terms of depression, a quantifier for depression or a diagnostic criteria essentially is like a flat or low affect that someone's always like an Eeyore vibe from Winnie the Pooh, like always flat, even though Eeyore has like friends and good days and ups and downs. He's mostly that like flat, dissonant, monotone affect, and that's consistent. And when I hear this song, that's what you hear, is that consistent tension, right? And there are certain lines lyrically that kind of nod to depression as well. Like, and I know that this might not be the writer's intent, but he talks about the sweater song and coming undone and pulling the thread as you walk away, how depression can come and go. And you can go in and out of depressive episodes. And that's also how we conceptualize the diagnostics around depression. Am I getting too intellectual?
In this podcast?
Yeah.
No, okay. I'm with you.
Okay, cool. So we have a couple different layers of depression. We have dysthymia, which is like a 2-week short-term depressive moment.
Dysthymia.
Okay. So I think it's D-Y-T-H. We don't have to spell it. And then we have depressive disorder, and then like a major depressive episode, and like clinical depression, which is, and it all is in terms of duration, right?
Okay.
Like how long does it last? We also have other depressive types of disorders, like adjustment disorders or like kind of short-term depression as a result of an outside, like something interfering with your life. So depression affects a ton of different people, all different demographics. So around 280 million people worldwide have depression, which is about 3.8 or around 4% of the population. What age group do you think depression's most prevalent in?
I want to say that it's like stereotypically going to be associated with young people, like, you know, 16 to 25 or whatever. I know that's not a demographic category, but I also know that my parents' generation could be depressed and are more likely to be socialized to not let anybody know. Yes. So I say that to mean my stereotypes and my assumptions have probably more to do with the fact that like it's more socially accept. Like if my kids become teenagers and they suffer from depression, they might tell me about it.
Sure.
Whereas I promise you, my mom and dad would not have told their parents about it if they were suffering from depression. So I have no idea, in other words, what really would be the right age.
That's really
the common one.
Really smart insight in that the demographics are changing, not because the prevalence is changing, which it probably is too, but I think the level of reporting is changing. So we see a lot of 18 to 29 year olds reporting depression because it's more socially acceptable and it's okay for them to talk about it, right? Now, like in that generation, which is very different from our parents and even our generation, sure. Like Gen Z is very kind of eager to report depression and eager to normalize these feelings because they are very normal feelings, with 30% of Americans feeling depressed at some point in their life. Like that's pretty normal.
And I think it's even like, as much as I can say, oh, it's generational or whatever, it's also life circumstance in the sense that when I was 25 years old, if I went into a bout of depression and I wanted to go seek help, nobody's relying on me. It's safe to do that. Whereas now, if I went into a bout of depression, I would feel, well, I can't admit to the world I'm depressed. I've got kids. I have a job. I can't, even though actually more is relying on me getting healthy
right,
now. So I think
sure.
It's not even just like, oh, to say my parents' generation wasn't okay. It was like, didn't feel okay to act on it because they were supposed to be holding it together as adults, right?
Yeah, just like, I mean, I don't know how you were brought up, but I was brought up for sure. Be like, okay, you're sad, you're struggling, just zip it up and keep going. Like you keep going. And that has taken a lot of unpacking in my parenting to like allow my kid to feel low and saying, it's okay if you're feeling anxious. It's okay if you're feeling sad today.
Yeah.
Because we weren't allowed to do that.
I don't like when I catch myself trying to convince my kids to be happy.
Like, stop crying.
Yeah. Like, why? Like, well, I'm not a stop crying guy.
Yeah. You can like,
but
cry.
But it's like almost like this, what right do you have to be sappy? Like, just be happy. If you're happy, you'll be happy. Like, just fake it till you make it. Even though don't they say like, if you smile, it actually will cause.
It does.
You can fake it till you make it a little bit.
You can trick your neurobiology for sure. Like you can.
But that doesn't cure depression.
It doesn't cure depression. But I mean, a lot of the depression meds, like that's what depression is, a biological disease. It's generational for sure. And it's a chemical imbalance. Like it's a lot of times depression is situational that just kicks in that chemical imbalance. And then that's why I think of this song. Right. Pull my thread as you walk away, that sometimes it just takes one circumstance to unravel someone if they already have a genetic predisposition toward depression, which is absolutely what happens.
Yeah.
And we see a high prevalence of like postpartum depression. Women are definitely more likely to report depression than men. So the statistics say that women experience depression more than men, which I would argue all day, and anyone in my field would say like it isn't. It's not that they experience it more than men. They just seek help more than men. So it's getting reported more that women are more depressed because they're the ones going to therapy, because our culture doesn't allow certain demographics to present in therapy.
Yeah. I mean, at the risk of oversharing, like just my own personal experience, I am not chemically predisposed towards depression, but I already don't remember the term. What's the short term situational?
Dysthymia.
Dysthymia. That's the short, like,
yeah,
I have
2 weeks. Yeah.
At a few points in my life. So longer than 2 weeks, I would think, but
yeah.
I would say in retrospect, I was depressed, and it was usually situationally, and not just like malaise of being a teenager. Like there were a few points up until my young adulthood where like, no, looking back, I was depressed. And I can promise you there was no part of me that had any interest in going and getting help in those moments.
Yeah,
I just
sure.
had to get through the situation that was causing it.
Absolutely.
And in my case, lucky for me, that was true, that once those situational stimuli changed and like I got my life together, I didn't have to suffer through that anymore. And but it does give me kind of a sense of empathy that like, that didn't make those moments, because I have friends who, I'm a musician, I play in bands. Like, of course I know people who suffer from depression. We've talked about it with people I've worked with, but I still remember those feelings, even though it's been some number of years, and how like it didn't matter that I knew that 2 months later I'd be fine and 2 months before that I was totally fine. In that moment, it was not crippling, and I was never that in dire straits, but and I did not feel socially okay to deal with it.
I mean, I'll say that there are definitely moments in my life, and not when I was an adolescent, but after I had my daughter, I had like some postpartum stuff, but also for me, and this is like a disclosure, after I had my daughter, I had a pretty severe brain injury that Mark knows about. And if you'd want more information on that, you can check out this episode of a Scissors and Scrubs podcast called Burnt Toast, where I detail into that. I had a brain aneurysm that had ruptured when I was about 5 days postpartum. And there you go. So a lot of times with brain injury, there is a comorbidity with depression afterwards, like concussions or brain aneurysms or strokes. After those moments, there is a higher risk of depression. So for me, I had that brain injury and I just had a baby. So I was really at risk for depression and I did feel depressed. And it was the first time I had ever felt those feelings after studying mental health academically for a really long time. I didn't understand it until I felt it. And now it's given me such empathy and insight towards students I work with. Like you can kind of almost, you can see it on someone now that you know what it feels like. Like you can see that it's like they have, someone told me depression was like having gray sludge running through your veins instead of blood. And I think that that is, I love a visual metaphor and that's how it feels. Like you just feel like you don't have any gas in your tank and you can see it in students now. So I'm thankful for my experience with depression and anxiety as well, because it helps me empathize with other humans in a way that I wouldn't be able to if I didn't experience it myself. So,
I mean, let me just say parenthetically, if you need help, please go get help.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that it's okay. Like, you know, the tagline is like, it's okay to not be okay. Like so many people experience depression, especially between like 12 and 25, like, and that population is so vulnerable. You can like inoculate them towards stigma, like or against stigma. There's something called attitudinal inoculation that we'd use in social psych.
Attitudinal?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Or I think it's attitudinal.
Attitudinal.
Inoculation. It's a social psych concept that means once you know about it, you're not going to fall victim to it.
Mm.
Like I know a lot about cults. I'm not going to fall victim to a cult because I know what
the
to look out
and
for.
Stuff, yeah.
Right. So if like we keep talking with our kids about mental health and, you know, I use language with my daughter, like you're feeling kind of, you don't feel sick, but you don't have energy. You don't feel like going to school. Like maybe today we take a brain break. Right. And we started doing that during COVID. Like you don't want to log into Zoom. Like, let's take a brain break today and we'll go for a walk and we'll get some healthy food and we'll find some friends to hang out with and we'll just like fill our buckets again. So tomorrow you can like do what you have to do. And I think it's so important to use that language with our children because then it inoculates them from falling into that trap of like, I just need to suck it up and keep moving forward.
I think so. What's so interesting about that as an idea is also the potential it has to help somebody actually know when something's really wrong.
Yeah.
Like I'm always, my son is very active. He plays a lot of sports. He's also gets injured a lot. He's got broken limbs, stuff like that. But also sometimes he gets hit by the pitch and he's hurt, but he's not injured.
Yeah.
And he's not yet old enough to really look at me and go, Dad, I'm cool.
Yeah.
He like in that moment, I think sometimes he doesn't know if he broke his leg or if he just kind of hurt himself.
Sure.
And I think this language, I don't know that when I was 25, I would know the difference between I just need a brain break and I'm having a quarter life crisis.
Yeah.
Like, I think you need to practice this language. You need to learn to recognize, oh my God, am I getting sick? I have a headache. No, I just need a cup of coffee. Like recognize the different layers of trouble you're in, so to speak.
And I think it's cool because I've been, you know, I'm a psychologist and I've been like putting this language into my kids since forever. And I always kept thinking like, is it doing anything? Like, it's just this like long con experiment I'm running on this subject I have. Of like, if I keep using language and modeling behavior that's inclusive to mental health concerns, right? Mm. Of like, you know, we were in that crowded museum and I don't know, like my body started feeling weird. Like my heart was beating fast and I got really sweaty and I was feeling really anxious in that moment. How did you feel in that moment, child? And she'll say, oh, I was fine. Or not. And now she's using language like she'll hang out with friends and come home. And I was like, oh, well, she'll come home and be kind of drained. I'm like, oh, are you okay? Like, did something happen? She's like, no, she'll say like, oh, my social battery's just empty. I need to recharge.
Wow.
Which I'm like, it's working. Like it's working. And she'll say like,
cool.
Oh, I'm feeling kind of low today. I think I just need some fruits and vegetables and a good night's sleep. I just think I need to take a long shower and have a good night's sleep and I'll feel better.
Yeah.
It's like, yes.
Wow.
So all we can do
as opposed to like swearing at you or something, just taking it out. You know?
She's a 10-year-old girl.
She might still. Yeah,
that's going to happen too a little bit. But I think that if we normalize mental health, we don't have to just suffer in silence. And, you know, to get back to the song, there's we haven't listened to a lot the audio where he's at the party and you can hear people like chatting in the background. And then
before the second verse.
But that like to me mimics how depression feels, like you're kind of in a bubble and people are like talking at you and talking around you, but you're not really dialed in to what they're saying. I get that vibe from this song of how depression feels.
I've never thought about that, but like maybe I need to get it. I'll get a clip of it.
Cool.
There's two guys talking and then a man and a woman talking in the second time. And one of the guys is all like exuberant and the other guy has a flat affect. Yeah. And then it's the flat affect guy we see later where the woman's like, oh, yeah,
I'm not going to go, but my friends like, want to go.
All right.
But,
yeah. And this is a guy that he's probably being flirted with by this girl. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, okay. And is that almost supposed to be interpreted as he's the main character of the song, the guy with the flat affect? I never thought of that
before. That's all I think about when I listen to this.
Wow, that's fascinating. See, this is great.
And then like the thread that goes through that, like, you know, dissonant chord that you were explaining that goes through. It is just that like rumination and those repeated thoughts of, you know, self, like it just is this underlying static that I think exists in a depressed mind.
Is this song better than I thought
it was?
This
is a great song.
I chose this song because I listened to the Blue Album relatively recently all the way through. And I've said it's not one of my favorite Weezer songs, certainly not off that album. And I was just struck by how much the Blue Note just infects it. And I was like, that has to be an episode despite me this being whatever song. Yeah. But I feel like I'm getting the song from an emotional... The moment you started talking about the flat affect of the song that is so Weezer.
Yeah.
But also so feeling of kind of depression in that kind of Gen X 90s way. It feels so 90s. And it's like, although alternative rock of that era has these, it's called, but sometimes stop start, where you'll have an extremely loud chorus and then a quiet verse.
Sure.
You know, think like Smells Like Teen Spirit, right? Mm-hmm. By Nirvana, of course. Aside from that, there's like not a lot of emotionality to the singing, to the guitar playing. Yeah. It's a lot of like dissonance without a lot of passion behind it, right? And it's the flat affect of the depression of the nihilistic 90s.
All I know is when I hear this song, it is undoubtable to me that whoever wrote this suffered from depression at some point in their life, because it's so representative of the vibe and the just the general. I mean, depression's a mood disorder, so I hate to say mood so much because it's it's punny if you know, but of the mood of the song, it does have a really depressed tonality to it. The lyrics note to a lot of depressive symptoms, and it's just, I think a lot of people related to it because it did appeal to an audience of like, 15 to, you know, late adolescence.
Yeah.
That like kind of maybe understood what this was like without naming it.
Yeah.
Because we weren't allowed to name it in the 90s that much.
Yeah. I think that's great that it can travel through the music that easily without me having any idea what this is about. But hang on a second. What am I trying to argue here? That this is a Blue Note from the blues from 19-aughts. And that note is usually the way it is to inspire melancholy. And the blues is sadness, but it's also like resignation to your lot in life. Like, it's not just, I'm sad you dumped me. There's something heavier and deeper about the idea of the blues. And here it is, even though I think Rivers thinks he's just channeling this Metallica riff, which isn't exactly a positive, you know, aesthetic source.
And like, the name of that Metallica song?
Welcome Home Sanitarium.
Okay.
It's not exactly like,
well, you know,
Happy
a sanitarium.
Birthday. Sure,
So
can we wrap up talking about music? I've got a few more examples of this Blue Note. Remember, the Blue Note is based on this chord. And it's the idea of that flat third note occurring against the major third. We already heard the key change went to that note. What happens in the last big chorus, which normally is just the Louie Louie progression? Let's You hear that epic chord they're hitting?
Yeah.
Guess which chord?
A natural.
It's the A chord.
Okay.
The A, not A sharp, the A natural, the flat third.
Wow.
It's the blue note. And it's this loud hit. The bass, the guitar, and the drums all hit bom, 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 right? And then that chorus ends with this squeaky high note. Rivers cracks his voice and it sounds great. And Brian Bell singing backup vocals. Listen here. What note is he singing?
It's the blue note.
He's hitting the blue note. And he's actually doing it like a blue note in the sense that he's
like
kind of out
ratchet.
Of tune.
Yeah.
And his voice cracking fits the sort of sloppiness of that flavor. And it's against the major chord below it. So we got the Louie Louie chord progression that does not have that A natural in it. It has A sharp. But he's doing it. And it works. And it feels very bluesy.
It does. It feels like he's submitting, kind of.
Ooh.
That's
submitting with a really powerful sort of...
Yeah, just a resignation.
Resignation. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And then we end with more of it. What you're going to hear is a guitar solo playing the blue note while the backing vocals are singing the really high blue note. So it starts as just a chord, even though that chord maybe has a legacy going back 100 years. There's like five disparate parts of the song that are all using just that single note that clashes in the chord.
Mm.
And it's a song about depression. So I feel like it works.
Allegedly. Blue
notes. Allegedly, yeah.
Blue album. And
that's
the
right. And the blue album. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Where are you at with sweaters? Are you a sweater
person? My gosh. You know, I'm so glad you asked. I love sweaters. I love sweater weather. I'm so excited.
Which here is a brief window of fall and spring.
I love fall. Fall's my favorite New England season. If you've never seen fall in New England, like, you know, it's the tops. So I'm pro sweaters, solid stance.
How about you? Fall is beautiful in New England, but the same weather happens in spring, except summer is on the other side of it. And look, everybody, I'm a professor. My work life is a little less busy over the summer.
Yeah.
When spring happens, it means, oh my God, we're almost done. We're almost done. Whereas fall is, oh my God, the winter's coming. But fall is very beautiful.
I kind of love it.
I love
like the start of the new academic year and like the energy and the excitement and like the potential it brings. I love that. And I don't really like spring because I have allergies.
That's tough. I don't really have hay fever as a problem. But
it's awful.
The sweater never was a force in my life until I moved here, because, you know, LA and San Diego, where I lived before I moved to New England, it gets cold. It could be quite cold. Like, you know, it'll hit 38 at night once in San Diego in January at 3 a.m. or whatever. That's right. But there's like a point where like I'm putting a jacket on.
Yeah.
If I don't have a jacket on, I'm like in short sleeve, right?
Sure.
But the sweater as it is an essential layer element also in New England. That was not, I don't know, this. The song seems to be about sweaters, but not about sweaters. So I thought I'd ask.
No, it's about covering up. It's about like putting armor on and protection on. And then someone pulls one thread of the sweater and then you're exposed.
Suddenly it's gone.
Yes. Right. If you could pick between a sweater and a hoodie, what would you be? I'm more of a hoodie.
I've never been hoodie.
Really?
So I've never. Well, do you do the hood on the hoodie?
Yeah. No,
I've never been a hat person until... Again, moving here and you have to have the beanie on or whatever when it's 20 degrees
cold,
out.
Yeah.
Now that I am fully immersed in youth baseball culture, I now am frequently wearing a hat when I'm at baseball practice. But, you know, I had the spiked hair when I was in my 20s and stuff like that. And the hat would compromise that. And so did the hoodie. So I've never been a hoodie guy. So I would go with a bold colored sweater any day over a hoodie.
I'd pick a hoodie over a sweater.
Yeah.
The end.
We're just going to have to learn to live with our disagreement here.
You know, it takes all kinds.
That's maturity also. Okay, Nicole, let's read the outro credits. I'm going to go first, then you. Go as fast as you can, okay? Nevermind the Music is hosted by me, Mark Poppany, and Nicole Vacher. I also produce. Please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating and a review. Let us know what you think on social media. We're at Never Music Pod on all the major platforms. You can also send us an email at nevermusicpod@gmail.com. Every so often, we'll do a mailbag episode where we'll answer all your burning questions. Thanks for listening. Go!
Never Mind the Music is hosted by me, Nicole Vadger, and Mark Pompany, who also produces. Please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating and review. Let us know what you think on social media. We're Never Music Pod on all major platforms. You can also send us an email at nevermusicpod@gmail.com. Every so often, we'll do a mailbag episode when we answer all your burning questions. Thanks for listening.